I want again to focus on three theological themes which arise in this period. I have a feeling that Andrew is much, much more sensible to focus on one, but still. And the first, rather obviously, is kingship. Israel's basic stance is the Lord is king. It was for this reason, as we've seen, that Samuel was so reluctant to give them a human king. And Gideon, earlier in the period of Judges, had made the same point. When they tried to make him king, and his children kings after him, he'd replied, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you, the Lord will rule over you." Judges 8:23. But the point is that even after the monarchy was introduced, Israel's basic position was still that the Lord was their king. The reference that I've given on the screen, 1 Chronicles 16:31, is actually from a psalm that David appointed the Levites to sing. And several of the psalms begin the same way. The Lord is king. For the theology of kingship in Israel, by far the most important chapter is 2 Samuel chapter 7. I'm going to ask you to turn to that if you would. Here God makes a covenant with David. There are many, many covenants in the Old Testament, but there is no question which are the three most important for the Old Testament itself. The covenant with Abraham, where God promised to give Abraham and his descendants children who would be the start of a nation, the land of Canaan, and through Abraham, blessing for all the world. That's the first covenant, first really important one. The second is the covenant, not as we often call it, with Moses, but with Israel through Moses, in which God promised to take Israel out, to take Israel out of all the nations of the world, to be their God, and for them to be his people, and the covenant with David, and through him with David's descendants. Now here God in the covenant promised David two things. First, there will always be a king from David's family. David, you remember, had wanted to build God a house. His request comes at the beginning of chapter 7. God refuses the request, but now turns the tables. I take up God's answer halfway through verse 11. Moreover, this is Nathan the prophet speaking, the Lord declares to you that the Lord will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you lie down with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring after you, who shall come forth from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. And again, verse 15, but I will not take my steadfast love from your descendant, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away from before you. Your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me. Your throne shall be established forever. A covenant, you may remember, is a binding commitment. It may go into abeyance for a time because of human sin, but it will never be rescinded. God has rejected the house of Saul. He never entered into a covenant with Saul. He will never take away his committed love for the house of David. And secondly, in the covenant with David, God promises that the king will be his adopted son. Verse 14 puts it very simply, I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. So the king of David's line was thought of in Israel as the Son of God. Not, of course, as a divine being, not for a moment to be worshipped, but in a very special relationship of love with God. And it's quite likely that Psalm 2 was regularly sung at a new king's coronation, with its famous verse 7, I will tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, this is probably the king talking, you are my son, today I have forgotten you. Not forgotten, begotten you. Today, that is on the day of his coronation probably, I have begotten you, I've taken you as my son. The king is God's viceroy. That is, he is to rule for God, ensuring that God's rule over Israel is a reality. One way in which this is explained comes in 1 Chronicles 28, verse 5. There David says, God has chosen my son Solomon to sit upon the throne of the kingdom of the Lord over Israel. Now the word kingdom here means not a place, a realm, but royal authority, dominion. So it is God who remains the true king of Israel, even in her greatest days of empire under David and Solomon. They merely sit on his throne, ruling for him. In practice, of course, Israel's kings proved unfaithful. They did not fulfill their obligations under the covenant with David, which were principally to obey God's law and to make sure that Israel kept true to God and his law. God's promise to be a father to David's descendants didn't rule out punishment, as you'll see if you still have 2 Samuel 7 open at verse 14. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. When he commits iniquity, I will punish him with a rod such as mortals use, with blows inflicted by human beings. And so it proved. In fact, eventually, 400 years and many generations after David himself, it got so bad that God had to destroy the Israelite kingdom, by then called Judah, altogether. And it looked as if the line of kings would be extinguished forever. But not with God. He had made a promise to David, a covenant with him. And as 2 Samuel 7:15 avows, I will not take my love from him, from the descendant of David. And so increasingly, we hear in the prophets the promise of a new king, a new David, a new Messiah, or rather a Messiah. Ezekiel promises that God's scattered people will be reunited, and as God says, I will set over them one shepherd, an image in the Old Testament frequently for a leader or king, I'll set over them one shepherd, my servant David, and he shall feed them. And this new hope in the prophets leads us, of course, to Jesus. Because Jesus is God's promised new king for his people. Turn, if you would, to Matthew chapter 1, verse 1. Now, you may have thought before that Matthew starts in a rather boring way. But here at the very outset of his gospel, Matthew introduces us to his central figure, chapter 1, verse 1. An account of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Jesus then is the Lord's anointed, that's what the word Messiah means, the anointed one, and the Lord's anointed is a frequent title for the king in the Old Testament, and he is also the son of David, the inheritor of God's covenant with David. So it's not surprising that on Palm Sunday, when Jesus fulfills the Old Testament prophecy about the new king. Look, your king is coming to you, humble and mounted on a donkey. That's an Old Testament quotation. The crowds cry out, Hosanna to the Son of David. Matthew chapter 21. Jesus is also God's chosen son. At his baptism, if you'll turn over to Matthew chapter 3 and verse 17, God's voice comes, This is my son, the beloved, with whom I am well pleased. At his transfiguration, This is my son, my chosen, listen to him. Luke 9. A part of what that is saying is, this is the king of David's line, with whom I'm taking up again my covenant promise. I will be a father to him, and he shall be a son to me. But in Jesus' case, it is, of course, also more than that. And John's gospel in particular teaches us that Jesus is God's only begotten son, who alone can say, the Father and I are one. And who, unlike any other king of David's line, can accept the worship of Thomas, who says, My Lord and my God. And Jesus, deliberately taking up the language of Ezekiel's promise, says, I am the good shepherd of God's sheep. He is, as the charge over the cross rightly said, the true king of the Jews, the king now of the whole world, great David's greater son. Closely associated with David is the second theme I want to follow through the Bible more briefly, Jerusalem. Jerusalem was much more than the capital city of a substantial empire, or at a later date, of a rather sadly reduced kingdom. It was, above all, the place where the temple was built, and therefore the place God chose for his special presence. You remember God caused the tabernacle to be constructed in the wilderness under Moses' leadership. This was the sign of God's special presence among his people, and it was, of course, movable. When on the move, the Levites carried its constituent parts in the middle of the people and set it up when they arrived at a new camp. By the time we come to Deuteronomy, the people of Israel are just about to conquer and enter the promised land. It was obvious that there would need to be a permanent place for God's sanctuary. So Moses says, You shall seek the place that the Lord your God will choose out of all your tribes as his habitation to put his name there. In other words, to make his presence especially be there. Deuteronomy 12, verse 5. And although in the period of Judges there were a few places where the tabernacle and the ark remained for a time, after Solomon built the temple and God himself fills it with his glory, this now becomes the definitive place for God's special presence. Second, Jerusalem is the place for worship. We tend to think of Jewish worship as home-based, especially the annual Passover celebrations. But in Old Testament times, the great festival worship took place at the temple, not in individual homes. Three times a year, all your males shall appear before the Lord your God at the place that he will choose. At the festival of unleavened bread, an old name for Passover, at the festival of weeks, and at the festival of booths, Deuteronomy 16:16. And it was, of course, for the Passover festival that Jesus and his parents made the long journey from Nazareth to Jerusalem when Jesus was 12, and Jesus, as you remember, of course, well got left behind. Luke chapter 2. But there was a second way in which the temple could be effective for worship. Effective prayer could be directed towards the temple. And perhaps you turn now to 1 Chronicles chapter 8. No, actually that's wrong. It is 1 Kings. I beg your pardon, I'm right. That's right, I'm wrong. 1 Kings is quite correct. My notes are wrong. Now 1 Kings 8 is Solomon's great prayer at the dedication of the temple. And he wants above all that the temple should be a place of effective prayer. So he says, for example, in 1 Kings 8 verse 33, this is in his own prayer, when your people Israel, having sinned against you, are defeated before an enemy, but turn again to you, confess your name, pray, and plead with you in this house, then here in heaven, forgive the sin of your people Israel, and bring them again to the land that you gave to their ancestors. But what if Israelites are away from Jerusalem? What if they can't get to the temple? Then they are to pray towards the temple. For example, verse 37. If there is famine in the land, if there's plague, blight, mildew, locust, or caterpillar, if their enemy besieges them in any of their cities, whatever plague, whatever sickness there is, whatever prayer, whatever plea there is from any individual or from all your people Israel, all knowing the afflictions of their own hearts, so that they stretch out their hands toward this house, then here in heaven your dwelling place, forgive, act, and render to all whose hearts you know according to all their ways. And you may remember how Daniel in Babylon, even when threatened with being thrown into the lion's den, continued 3 times a day to get down on his knees in prayer and praise with, I quote, windows in his upper room open toward Jerusalem. Daniel 6 verse 10. But the Old Testament sometimes opens out onto a wider view. Jerusalem is the place of God's presence, not only for the people of Israel, but for all nations. It is to be the joy of all the earth. Great is the Lord, says Psalm 48, and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, that is, of course, Jerusalem. The holy mountain, his holy mountain, Jerusalem's built on a mountain, or several actually. His holy mountain, beautiful in elevation, is the joy of all the earth. Mount Zion, the city of the great king. And Isaiah prophesies in chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. In days to come, the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be raised above the hills. All the nations shall stream to it. Many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth instruction, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. Now all this may seem rather intriguing to us. We wish we'd been able to see the Jerusalem temple, now long since destroyed. But it also may seem to us rather foreign. We imagine that we have no temple where God's presence is concentrated, and we have no special city where God rules. But that's where we're wrong. The New Testament teaches us that Jesus is the new temple where God dwells bodily. Turn, if you would, to John's Gospel, chapter 2. and towards the end of that. You remember the incident at the end of the chapter where Jesus angrily drove the money changers out of the temple. The Jews asked him what authority he can show for this kind of act. And this is his reply, John 2:19-21. Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "This temple has been under construction for 46 years. And will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of his body. Now, we know this image. Jesus calls his body this temple. But in what way is his body like the Jerusalem temple? In what way is the Jerusalem temple a picture, a foreshadowing of Christ's body? In other words, why didn't Jesus turn to a tree and say, "Destroy this tree and I'll build it up and raise it up in 3 days"? Why did he pick the image of the temple? Simply because just as God put his name, his special presence, into the temple, so God puts himself, all of himself, bodily into Jesus. That is what is meant by the famous verse, if you would turn back to it, John 1:14. "And the Word became flesh and lived among us. And we have seen his glory, the glory of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth." Literally, the Word became flesh and pitched a tent, or lived in a tent among us. A reference to the Old Testament tabernacle, the precursor of the temple. So God became a human being and came among us as Jesus, the new tabernacle, John 1:14, the new temple, John 2:19-21, where God and his glory can be met. And just as there's a new temple for Christians, so there is a new city where God rules his people. And this is not so much the church on earth, although we are already united to it, as the church in glory. And perhaps you turn now to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews, the last big book in the Bible apart from Revelation. So if you're going from Revelation, probably easiest to go through little letters of John, little letters of Peter. Hebrews chapter 12. Got into any of Paul's letters, go back towards Revelation. Now the writer has just said here that Old Testament religion, for which the book of Hebrews doesn't have a great deal to say, positively, has a great deal to say, just not very positively, that Old Testament religion can be summed up as Mount Sinai and the experience there of receiving God's law, which he describes from verse 18 onwards as awesome, dark, frightening. And now comes the experience of the New Testament people of God, Hebrews 12:22-23. "But you have come," now listen to all these Jerusalem images, "to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus." Now this is a description of the church in heaven, with on the one hand innumerable angels, and on the other the spirits of righteous people made perfect. Why can it be so readily compared to Mount Zion? Why is it called the heavenly Jerusalem? Because in the Old Testament, Jerusalem is above all the city where the Lord is king. And under the new covenant, the church, and especially the church in glory, the church in heaven, is the place where God is king and God rules his people. And last, and I'm afraid rather unsatisfactorily briefly, I move to a theme which is perhaps not strictly theological, to literature. The reigns of David and Solomon saw a great blossoming of Israelite literature, of which perhaps the most notable was the Psalms. The Psalms were by no means all written by David. In fact, some of them were written in the exile, at least 400 years after David. But there's every reason to believe that David did write a number of Psalms and encouraged the writing of others. The Psalms show very considerable variety. Many of them show a deeply personal faith. Turn, for example, to Psalm 18. Psalms are more or less dead in the middle of the Old Testament, between Job and Proverbs. Psalm 18. Let me read, first of all, the superscription of the psalm. That is the little bit before verse 1. Psalm 18. To the leader. A psalm of David, the servant of the Lord, who addressed the words of this song to the Lord on the day when the Lord delivered him from the hand of all his enemies and from the hand of Saul. He said. Now this, like all the superscriptions, was added later to the psalm, but is nevertheless very old, and there's no need to doubt its authenticity. The psalm stems then from the period when David was on the run from Saul. Now look at some of the verses. Verses 1 and 2. I love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock, my fortress, and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield, and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. Verse 6. In my distress I called upon the Lord. To my God I cried for help. From his temple he heard my voice. Note the connection there. And my cry to him reached his ears. Verse 16. He reached down from on high. He took me. He drew me out of mighty waters. He delivered me from my strong enemy and from those who hated me, for they were too mighty for me. We tend to think of Old Testament religion as rather impersonal, all to do with priests and sacrifices and keeping the law. Many of the Psalms give the lie to that impression. But also several Psalms show a life of corporate worship. And I'd like you now to turn, if you would, as an example, to Psalm 118. So turn on 100 Psalms. It may be that after the opening verse, verses 2 to 4 show different groups of worshippers participating. First the whole congregation, then the priests, the descendants of Aaron only, then the whole congregation again. I read from verse 1. Oh, give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His steadfast love endures forever. Let Israel say, his steadfast love endures forever. Let the house of Aaron say, his steadfast love endures forever. Let those who fear the Lord say, his steadfast love endures forever. And listen at the end of the psalm to how one worshipper, maybe the king, probably calls from outside the temple and the others answer from within. The lone worshipper speaks first in verse 19. Open to me the gates of righteousness, that I may enter through them and give thanks to the Lord. Here's the response. This is the gate of the Lord. The righteous shall enter through it. And as he comes in procession, verse 26, Blessed is the one who comes in the name of the Lord. We bless you from the house of the Lord. The Lord is God, and he has given us light. Bind the festal procession with branches up to the horns of the altar. So, some psalms, originally written for individual devotion, came to be used in the corporate worship of Israel, as we use them still today. And other psalms were written for corporate worship from the start. And then secondly, there is the wisdom literature. In the Bible, principally the books of Proverbs, Job, and Ecclesiastes. In Old Testament Israel, there were three main types of religious official. Not the bishop, the vicar, and the curate, but the priest, the prophet, and the wise man. The wise man was both a political counselor and an educator, drawing not only on Israelite traditions, but also, because he belonged to an international circle of wise men, to the traditions of wisdom of other countries. Solomon himself was the supreme example. The most characteristic product of the wise men in the Old Testament is the book of Proverbs, largely composed of pithy sayings born out of a long experience of life. The purpose of this compilation is clearly explained in Proverbs chapter 1. If you would turn to that, you'll only have to turn on about 8 pages from where you are. Let me read verses 2 to 6. For learning about wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for gaining instruction in wise dealing, righteousness, justice, and equity, to teach shrewdness to the simple, knowledge and prudence to the young, let the wise also hear and gain in learning, and the discerning acquire skill to understand a proverb and a figure, the words of the wise and their riddles. Here then is wisdom with which to master life, both morally, to make the right choices in life, that's the main emphasis in verses 2 to 5, and intellectually, because as verse 6 puts it, to understand a proverb and to work out a riddle is also part of gaining control intellectually of a life that would otherwise be confusing. The book of Job presents us with wisdom with which to face suffering. Job and his counselors, comforters, constantly ask why he's suffering. The book gives no answer. It merely says that God's work is far greater and far more glorious than we can possibly comprehend. But it does tell us the only godly and the only productive way to respond to suffering. To quote Job himself, "The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And then there is Ecclesiastes, which is almost like a revolt by the wise men against their own tradition. It doesn't glory in what the wise mind can achieve, but it shows the wisdom with which to recognize our own limitations, both intellectually, because as Ecclesiastes said, "When I applied my mind to know wisdom, then I saw that no one can find out what is happening under the sun. Even though those who are wise claim to know, they cannot find it out." And morally, one of Ecclesiastes' bleak conclusions is, "See, this alone I found, that God made human beings straightforward, but they have devised many schemes." So this was a rich period in Israel's literary history, with many of the Psalms being written, several collections of Proverbs being made, history writing probably flourishing in the annals of the kings, which we begin to hear mentioned at this stage in the Old Testament, and perhaps also the more skeptical literature like Job or Ecclesiastes, whether these particular books were composed now or later being written. But each type of literature points beyond itself, looking for something further, God's final revelation. Ecclesiastes certainly doesn't have the answers to life. And nor in the end do the Proverbs or even the Psalms. And it reminds us that all the Old Testament literature is written to prepare us for Christ. Not, of course, all speaking directly about Christ, but all making us yearn for Christ and to reach out for Christ. There are three parts to the Old Testament, sometimes called the Law, the Prophets, and the Psalms, because the Psalms is the first book of the other writings. And Jesus himself said in Luke 24:44, on the road to Emmaus, "These are my words that I spoke to you while I was still with you, that everything written about me in the Law of Moses, the Prophets, and the Psalms must be fulfilled." I think that was just after he'd got back from the road to Emmaus. Yeah, when he was with them in the upper room.